I had the right to ask her to get off my property. But I was wrong. Way wrong. She had used all her powers to conjure up the greatest sob story the cops had ever heard. She set me up. "Mr. Lee," the officer said on the intercom, "you are going to have to let her in to collect her things." "Dude," I protested, "she's got my ring." "That's not my concern," he said. "She needs to come in and remove her possessions." I threw up my hands and opened the fucking door. The cop barged in, followed by Bobby. She marched straight to the bedroom. I tried to follow her, but the cop stopped me. "Don't go in there." I lost it.
"What do you mean, don't go in there? That's my fucking bedroom, and that's my personal stuff in there."
"I want you to wait outside and keep quiet."
"This is bullshit. I'm not gonna do shit to her."
"Did you hear what I said, Mr. Lee?"
"I fucking heard you. I just want to make sure she doesn't take any of my stuff. I have that right, don't I?"
I guess I didn't have that right, because before I knew it, I was thrown to the ground, handcuffed, and pushed into the back of their cop car.
"What are you taking me to jail for?"
I yelled as they drove away. "Assault."
"What?"
"The lady says you tried to strangle her." Since it was a Friday night, they kept me there for the rest of the weekend, which gave Bobby just enough time to clean my entire fucking place out. When I came home Monday morning to find all the rooms empty, chairs, tables, bed, everything, I wasn't even surprised. I was just curious as to where she'd found a moving company willing to work on weekends. I hope she had to pay them some serious overtime, because I know they worked hard. All they left me was one fork in the dishwasher. But here's a sick thing about love. I fucking missed her. And she was totally missing me, too. So just days after I was released from jail, I found myself in the apartment she had rented after leaving my house. Fucking her on my old bed, dude. We weren't really going out again, but we weren't quite broken up either. It turned into one of those relationships that just needs to be shot and put out of its fucking misery. We were holding each other back from life, from meeting other people. But at the same time, we couldn't get enough of each other. The second or third time we hooked up after jail, she started bitching me out because she thought I was interested in one of her hot friends. She stomped and screamed around the house for fucking hours without a break. I tried to laugh it off, and it only made her madder. I tried to ignore her, and it only incensed her more. I tried to reason with her, and she just grew angrier. Finally, I couldn't take it anymore. I didn't know how to stop the noise. I grabbed a fucking vase off the table, smashed it on the ground, said, "You're a fucking asshole," and split. I was so upset. I couldn't get rid of this crazy fucking woman or my crazy fucking feelings for her. And nothing was working. I needed to escape from this shit, get my mind off it, stop the noise. Why was I still even wasting my time on this bitch who had set me up? So I went to visit a friend named Sedge, who was a full-on fucking Nikki Sixx junkie. When I walked in, he was sitting on the sofa juicing up.
"Hey, bro, hook me up," I begged. "I don't want to feel a fucking thing right now."
"No problem," he said, rubbing his fingers together in what would have been a snap if he wasn't too junked out to generate enough friction. I rolled up my sleeve, tied myself off with a piece of medical rubber tubing on the table, and waited for him to prepare the syringe. I saw him lower it into a spoon and draw 2 cc's.
"Bro, I'm not like you," I told him. "I don't do this all the time. That might be too much for me."
"Nah, don't worry about it," he half-snapped. "It's fine. Trust me, dude. I'm a junkie. I know what I'm doing."
"Fuck it. Whatever."
Those words, "Trust me, I'm a junkie," should have been a clue right there. I mean, he was a fucking addict, dude, so of course his tolerance was going to be more than mine. He stabbed my arm, released the 2 cc's into my system, pulled the needle out, and untied me. I entered fucking paradise. I was so fucking happy. I didn't feel a thing. My body relaxed, the words Bobby and Brown disappeared from my consciousness, and a stream of pleasure shot out from my heart and flooded my body. I dropped back into the couch and closed my eyes.
Chapter 2. Nikki. In which Nikki smells a rat and devises a method for its extermination. When we were touring with Corabi in Europe, there was a press conference in Italy. And this phenomenally beautiful Italian journalist stood up and said, Nikki, I want to ask you a question. She had blowjob lips, flowing auburn hair, and looked just like Raquel Welch playing the role of Lust in the movie Bedazzled. Do you ever thank God for making you so beautiful? No, I answered her. I curse him for making my dick so small. After the press conference, she invited me to join her for coffee so that we could talk more. Well, you know I'm married, I told her. No, no, just talking, she said, still looking like Lust. Maybe we will go together tomorrow. Call me. The next morning, instead of calling my room, she knocked on the door. I dragged myself out of bed, opened the door, and she barged in and slipped out of her boots, skirt, and tight sweater. Her body was unbelievable. Perfect, golden brown skin with shampoo commercial hair, cascading over full breasts, mounted in a red push-up bra. My morning wood pushed against my underpants. She pushed me down on the bed, said, "Let's see if God really cursed you." And we started rolling around. But just as I was about to fuck her, she said, "You have a rubber, right?" "No, I don't." "Then I'll be right back," she said, and slipped into her clothes. When she left, I took a moment to think. What was I doing? I almost fucked this chick. I'm married. I have children. Screwing this very beautiful Italian woman who's driving me crazy with lust is a waste of time. I slipped into my clothes, went across the hall to Mick's room, and watched her return with the rubbers, only to find nobody home. A few weeks later, I was in London with my wife, Brandy. Our record label threw us a party full of freaks like midgets, stilt walkers, and English rock stars. Suddenly, there was a commotion at the door, and a woman was yelling, "I will not be treated this way! I am the press!" It was the ravishing Italian journalist. She pushed past security and marched right toward me. "Where the fuck did you go?" she demanded. Brandy turned to me, and I went red in the face. I escaped out the back door with Brandy in pursuit, cursing at me the whole way. I learned an important lesson that night. If I had just fucked that Italian instead of staying faithful, none of this ever would have happened. By that point, my marriage was in the gutter anyway. The love that had blossomed out of my sobriety during the making of Dr. Feelgood was just a momentary obsession egged on by the fact that I hardly ever saw her, so I didn't know what she was really like. By the time we discovered we weren't right for each other, she was already pregnant with our first child, Gunner. I consoled myself by spending as much time with our children as I could. She consoled herself by spending as much of my money as she could. And that's how I ended up in a 15,000-square-foot mansion full of white marble and tiled pools and 60-foot ceilings. It was a nightmare. But I couldn't bring myself to leave her because I remembered all too well what my life had been like without a father. So much of my anger and violence, and probably the reason I always pushed myself to the point of self-destruction with drugs, was because I was still pissed at my father for abandoning me to a rootless, nomadic existence with my mother and her various husbands. I had been through so much with Motley Crue, but none of it could heal or fade those scars. I didn't want my three children to grow up with those same scars. While we were recording a bonus EP called Quaternary, which means the power of four, with Karabi, I wrote a song called Father, and just lost my mind in the music, asking, "Father, where are you?" in the chorus. I began to think that the hole in my life was probably mirrored in his life, that it must be hard for him to know he has a son he can't communicate with. The last time I had spoken with my father was in 1981, when he basically disowned me, and I changed my name. Over a decade had passed since then. I was a father now, and I thought that he'd want to know he was a grandfather. Perhaps we could even begin to repair the damage between us. Now that I was 37, maybe it was time to finally bury the adolescent angst which had fueled my whole life. The last place I knew he had worked at was a pool construction company in San Jose, so I called information for the number, dialed it, and asked if Frank Ferrana was still working there. "Who wants to know?" a voice asked. "I'm his son. I'm trying to find him." "Randy? Who's Randy?" "Well, whoever you are, Frank Ferrana's dead, been dead a long time." "Wait, don't call here again." They hung up. I called my mother in Seattle to see if she knew what had happened to my father. She insisted that he was alive. I tried to pull more details out of her and asked if the name Randy meant anything to her, but it was no use. The lyrics I had written for Primal Scream on Decade of Decadence kept spinning through my head. When Daddy was a young man, his home was living hell. Mama tried to be so perfect, now her mind's a padded cell. And I had to hang up before I started screaming at her again. I was too old to let my mother keep pushing all the buttons that set me off, even if she was the one who had originally put them there. My whole life has always been a big mystery, and it didn't seem like she was going to help clear it up anytime soon. The next day, Brandy told me that she wanted to take a vacation. "Where should we go?" I asked her. But I had misheard her. She wanted to go alone. Some girlfriends of hers were going to Hawaii, she explained, and she wanted to join them and clear her head. "Things have been hard lately," she said, "and I don't know what I'm looking for, but I need to find it." "If that's the problem, maybe we should spend some time together. We can find a babysitter for the kids, go away together, and try to figure things out." But she insisted on flying to Hawaii without me, and that's when I first smelled a rat. I hired a private detective to follow her, and it seems that what she was looking for was not herself, but a man named Adonis. Why is it that the other guy is always an Adonis or a Thor or a Jean-Claude? To make matters worse, Adonis was the brother of an executive who I hung out with. In other words, Adonis had been in my house with his sister and brother dozens of times, and I had innocently welcomed him in and treated him like a friend. I felt like a fool, a cuckold. Here I was trying to make this marriage work, and she was running off and leaving me with the kids so she could bask in the sun with some Greek playboy in Honolulu, on my dime. Everyone at Electra probably knew what was going on behind my back. I knew I should have fucked that Italian journalist. The private investigator said he had photographs, but I didn't want to see them. It all made perfect sense. Adonis, I remembered, had a house in Hawaii. He also had a house in Santa Monica. The private investigator called a few days later to tell me that they had returned to Los Angeles. Brandy still hadn't called me, and I was so pissed off about being betrayed, misled, and humiliated that I decided to kill the Adonis bastard she was sneaking around with. I grabbed a double-barreled shotgun, hopped in my Porsche, and peeled out toward the Pacific Coast Highway. As I sped downhill, I planned out exactly what I was going to do when I arrived. I was going to knock on his door and say, "Hi, you may remember me. My name is Nikki, and you've been fucking my wife." Then I was going to unload both barrels in his nuts.
Chapter 3. Tommy. In which our persistent hero discovers that money can't buy him love unless he is spending it at the pleasure chest. When I woke up, everything had totally changed. The face of a man in white with glasses was hovering inches away from mine, and the first words out of his mouth were, "You're lucky to be alive, sonny. Real, real lucky." I figured I was in some kind of junked-out dream, and I blinked my eyes and tried to figure out what was going on. "Where am I?" No one answered me. The dude was gone. I wasn't sure if he was a dream, a madman, or guardian spirit trying to give me a message. I was in a white room, kind of like heaven, but also institutional-looking. It was a hospital. Not only was I in complete pain, but my skin had turned a shade of blue. The events of hours before came flooding back to me. That motherfucker Sedge had almost killed me. Later that night, Sedge and a friend of mine named Doug came to visit. Sedge threw a bag full of clothes on the bed and said, "T, we're getting you the fuck out of here." "Why, dude?" "Because if you stay here any longer, the fucking media are gonna find out and have a fucking field day. So shut up and follow me. Trust me." In my half-conscious state, I knew I'd heard those words before, but I couldn't remember where. Sedge and Doug tore the tubes out of my arms and pulled off the wires attaching me to various machines whose function I was completely oblivious to. I was worried that one of those tubes or wires was keeping me alive, and if they pulled one out, dude, I'd die. But then I realized if I was lucid enough to worry about it, I was probably okay. They helped me put on my pants, boots, and T-shirt,
Then we ran down the corridor and out of the hospital as fast as we could. No one stopped us. No one said a word. And no one ever found out about it, including Bobby. The next time Bobby and I saw each other was on New Year's Eve, 2 days later. I went out with some of my best bros to a club called Sanctuary, and Bobby met us there. We all sat in a booth popping E, drinking champagne, and being fucking maniacs. In an hour, it would be 1995, and we'd probably be too fucked up to even know what day it was. Suddenly, a waitress came over and said,
"Tommy, here's a shot of Goldschlager. It's for you, from Pamela Anderson."
"Pamela Anderson?"
"Yes, she's one of the owners of the club."
"Is she here?"
"She's right there."
The waitress pointed to a table in the corner where Pamela was sitting, surrounded by friends. I couldn't believe I hadn't noticed her before. She was wearing all white. Her hair was the most perfect shade of blonde I'd ever seen. Her teeth practically glowed through her lips when she laughed, and she stood out so radiantly from everyone around her that it seemed like a beam of black light was shining on her from above. I lifted the shot, did something corny like winked or smiled, and slammed it. And then I grabbed a whole bottle of Cristal and guzzled it like a happy pig. I put it down, walked over to her table, and blew up the area. "Hey, Pamela, I'm Tommy," I said suavely. "But I guess you know that since you sent me a shot," I continued, not so suavely. "Thanks." I needed to recover from such a stupid line. So I pushed my way into the booth, slid over her girlfriend's laps, and forced myself a space right next to her. Then I grabbed her face and just licked the side of it, from chin to temple. Maybe if I had done that when I was sober, I would have seemed like some kind of invasive asshole. But I was on ecstasy, so it was all good, and anything I did was not rude. It was innocent and full of love and a yearning to bond with all of humanity. She fucking laughed and, without missing a beat, turned away and licked the face of the girl next to her. Then fucking everyone started passing licks around the table. On ecstasy, Joan Rivers looks like Pamela Anderson, so imagine what Pamela Anderson looked like. She was so beautiful, I couldn't even bring myself to think of defiling her with thoughts of lust. I just stared at her all night, and she just stared back. We probably talked about something for those hours, but I can't remember what. I didn't even realize midnight had passed until 10 minutes later, when Bobby walked by the table and said, with all the bitchy attitude she could muster, "Happy New Year." She tried to shoot all the fucking negative vibes she could from her eyes, but my ecstasy defense system was too strong. I wished Bobby a Happy New Year, too, then turned back to Pamela. I didn't want to give Pamela the impression that Bobby and I were dating, especially since our relationship had degenerated to nothing but overdoses and late-night phone calls to the police. Little did I know what was in store for me. I was ready for a change, and God, how I hoped Pamela would be that change. At 1:30, with Bobby firing dirty looks from the bar all night, Pamela said she had to leave. Her friends were tired and wanted to go home. In all my years of experience, I have yet to devise a way of separating a woman I want from her fucking friends who are bored because they aren't getting any attention. I walked Pamela to her girlfriend Melanie's car, asked for her digits for the 10th time that night, and finally got them, and laid a huge fucking sloppy kiss on her. I was cocky on ecstasy and Cristal. I later found out that when Pamela closed the car door, the first thing Melanie did was look at her and say,
"Don't even think about it." "What do you mean?" Pamela tried to ask innocently. "Listen to me. That guy is a fucking maniac."
Pamela smiled guiltily. Melanie looked over at her and said one more time to make sure it sank in,
"No."
The problem with meeting someone you like in Los Angeles is that everybody is always too busy to get together. Their first priority is their career. Making a friend or going on a fucking date is like sixth on the list. So when I called Pamela and she couldn't seem to settle on a day to hang out, I figured this would be another one of those fucking L.A. hookups that start out with so much promise but never get off the ground. Instead, they just sort of dwindle away as, with each phone call and promise to try to get together next week, each person grows more distant, and the spark that ignited at their meeting fizzles out. After 6 weeks of this telephonic fucking cock-teasing, I finally got the message I'd been waiting for.
"Tommy, damn, you're not there. It's Pamela. I've got 24 hours to play, and I want to play with you. Call me at the Hotel Nikko at 6 p.m., and we'll rendezvous.
I was so fucking psyched, dude. My experiences with Heather had taught me that clean-cut actress chicks want a bad boy. So, instead of buying new clothes and shaving and trying to look all fresh like Pamela, I put on my dirtiest fucking leather pants, slipped into an old t-shirt that stank of B.O., and didn't bother to shave or shower. I did, however, brush my teeth. I drove to the pleasure chest and picked up $400 worth of sex toys and outfits. I had my overnight duffel in one hand and a shopping bag full of lubricants and vibrating clitoral stimulators and Benoit balls in the other. I was ready to rock her fucking world. I called her hotel at 4:59 p.m. I couldn't wait. The receptionist said she hadn't arrived yet. I drove around, killed some time, and called back 5 minutes later. She still wasn't there. I grabbed some food and called back. No answer. I finished my meal, called again, and she still hadn't shown up. Now it was 6 p.m. I drove to the hotel, and I waited in the lobby for another hour. Then I headed back to my house, calling the hotel every 5 minutes until they began to pity me.
"Sorry, she's still not here," the receptionist said. "You'll be okay. I'm sure she'll be here any minute. If you want to give me your number, maybe I could call you when she shows up." Excuse me?
I left messages at her pad, at her friends' houses, everywhere. I was just hunting her down like a little fucking stalker, the exact same way I had chased after the first girl I ever kissed with the red berry. Finally, just before 10 p.m., Pamela picked up the phone. She wasn't even at the fucking hotel. She was at home.
"Hey, what's up?"
she asked, as if she were surprised I was calling. "Dude, what are you doing right now?" I was exploding. I needed to see her.
"I'm walking out the door."
"What do you mean?"
"I'm taking a plane to Cancun tonight. I have to be there for a photo shoot tomorrow morning."
"Oh, really? What about me?"
"Oh, no," she said. "We were supposed to get together tonight, right?"
"I think so."
"I'm so sorry. Listen, when I get back, I promise."
"We could get together before then," I hinted.
"Oh, no," she said. "Don't even think about it."
"What do you mean?" I protested innocently.
"Don't even think about coming. I have a lot of work to do. They've got me booked for 18-hour days, and there's no time to play."
"Okay, it's cool," I relented. "Have fun. I'll talk to you when you get back." I hung up the phone, called two of my friends, and said, "Pack your bags. We are going to Cancun." I dialed American Airlines, booked a flight, and called her home from the plane the next day. "I'm on an airplane right now having cocktails," I said to her machine. "And I'm coming to find your ass." I bet she wished she'd never given me her home number. Half an hour later, I checked my answering machine, and there was a message from her.
"You are out of your mind," she yelled. "Don't come down here. This is not a vacation. This is a work trip. Do not come down here."
But it was too late. When I arrived, I called every hotel on the strip searching for her. The sixth hotel on my list was the Ritz-Carlton, and when they said there was a Pamela Anderson staying there, I practically wet myself with excitement. She wasn't in the room, of course, so I left her a message or six, asking if she wanted to meet for a drink that night. Evidently, she wasn't even going to return my call. She was so pissed. But her friends were on my side this time. They saw how hard I was working and begged her.
"Just go out with him for one drink. It couldn't hurt."
Well, it did hurt, because 4 days later, we were married. I showed up in the lobby of the Ritz-Carlton in a tank top, ripped jeans, and tats hanging out everywhere. They refused to let me anywhere near the bar or the restaurant, so we decided to fuck that piece of shit hotel and go elsewhere. As I was letting her into the cab, I paused to look at her, and I never stopped looking. We found a place called Señor Frog's, which reeked of spilled beer and margarita vomit. We were both shy and embarrassed, especially after all the build-up leading to this first date. But as the night progressed, Señor Frog's turned into the sanctuary. The magic returned without the ecstasy, and the outside world melted away. She had that one drink she promised me, and that drink led to another drink, and that other drink led to some other drinks, and all those drinks combined led to her hotel bed. When we finally fell asleep, That was the first time the entire night that we stopped looking into each other's eyes. We hung out every fucking night after that. We went to clubs, to restaurants, to bars, to the beach, and all we did was stare at each other and kiss each other all night. Then we went home and made golden love. She was in the penthouse suite, and the elevator opened directly into her room, where there was a pool and a waterfall, both of which we took advantage of. I couldn't believe that it was possible to feel so happy. It was stronger than any ecstasy I'd ever had. I was literally incapable of thinking a bad thought about myself, about Motley Crue, about Vince. For a so-called bad boy, I was turning into a pansy. It felt like our hearts had been hot glued together. When she was working, I'd just sit in my hotel room like a dead man and wait for her to call so I could come back to life again. I even phoned my parents and thanked them for raising such a spoiled little brat who couldn't handle not having something he wanted, because otherwise, I never would have had the confidence to stalk Pamela like I did. When her shoot ended, we decided to stay in Cancun 2 more days. That night at a disco called La Boom, I took off my pinky ring, put it on her finger, and asked her to marry me. She said yes, hugged me, and stuck her tongue down my throat. The next morning, we decided that we had been serious and asked the hotel to find someone to perform a marriage ceremony. We gave blood, sniffed out a marriage license, and were on the beach in our swim trunks getting married before the day was over. Instead of wedding bands, we went for something more permanent, tattoos of each other's names around our fingers. The next morning, we boarded the plane to fly back to Los Angeles. The closer we came, the harder reality began to hit us. This was real. We were married. She asked me, "Where are we going? Do you want to go to your house or mine?" "I've got a place in Malibu, right on the beach." "Okay, then we're going to your house." The moment we walked off the plane at LAX, the shitstorm hit. The airport was swarming with fucking photographers. We fought our way to my car and drove to my place. I glanced up at the hill overlooking the house, and dudes with cameras were camped out everywhere. It was like we had gone from total freedom paradise of Cancun to this hellish prison of Hollywood Babylon. We hired a 24-hour security guard, but we still couldn't do shit without this lynch mob following us everywhere. Things only got worse when Pamela called home to tell her family the news. Her mother fucking flipped out and told her to file for divorce immediately, while her brother asked for my address so he could come over and personally kick my ass. They basically disinherited her and refused to recognize our marriage. In the meantime, Bobby had left 20 messages. She had heard on the news that Pamela and I were married, and she was pissed. As far as she was concerned, we were still going out.
Chapter 4 Nikki. In which a libertine who, in past adventures, nary blinked when inserting a telephonic implement in a woman's maidenhead, finds himself distraught by ordinary dating. At the bottom of the hill where the Pacific Coast Highway meets Canaan Doom Road, my eyes unclouded and I had a moment of clarity. I screeched to a halt in front of the World Gym, threw open the door, and unloaded the gun into the stop sign there. I was still pissed, but I wasn't stupid like OJ. I wasn't going to let Brandy destroy my life any more than she already had. I sat down by the side of the road and started crying. I couldn't take it anymore. She was destroying me, and she was destroying the children. This new piece of expensively bought information made it impossible to continue to tolerate her shopping sprees and meanness around the house. I had to get away from her. I wanted so badly for Brandy and I to be everything that my parents never were, but it was impossible when my relationship had crumbled from beneath me. When I confronted Brandy and asked for a divorce, our relationship turned from marriage to war, and she left the house threatening to take from me everything I owned and loved. I never realized how lonely the mansion could be. Not only was I now living by myself, fighting for my children in a custody battle, but I wasn't speaking to my mother, and I didn't know if my father was alive or dead. As for my band, the only real support system I had my whole life, they were a mess. Every day in the studio trying to make Generation Swine felt like an episode of Dynasty, with everybody plotting behind each other's backs. After I showed an engineer friend a song I had written at the height of my depression called Song to Slit Your Wrists By, he insisted I get out of the house. He started begging me to go out with a friend of his from Pasadena. She's an awesome girl, he promised. I don't know, I told him. I'm not really into dating right now. I just want to try and get my kids back. Nikki, you need to go out with someone. Snap out of it. She's a nice girl. You'll like her. I caved in and called her. She seemed nice enough, so I invited her out for some food. It was so out of character with how I used to meet girls before I was married, when all I had to do was lean against the sheetrock of the starwood and look cool. The drive to her place in Pasadena took an hour and a half. I arrived, opened the door, and sure enough, the bitch was cockeyed. Just like Angie Saxon's old roommate. She looked like a drunk Gina Davis. As soon as I entered her shabby chic house, I wanted to turn and flee. This was not my style at all. But I had driven all the way there, and she looked so desperate and expectant. So I took her someplace suitably pathetic, like Chili's. She kept pounding scotches while I sat there watching, because there was no way I was going to drive all the way home drunk. The more she guzzled, the louder and more obnoxious she became. Normally, I would have been just as drunk and loud, but sober, I didn't know how to deal with it. I just cowered and sank deeper into my chair. I took her back to her place, and she pulled me inside and asked if I wanted to watch TV. I made an excuse, but she sat me down and flipped on Fox anyway. "This is my favorite show," she said. It was Cops. I sat as far away from her on the couch as I could. During a commercial, she scooted onto the middle cushion. After a few more minutes of silence, she asked, "Do you want anything?" "I'll have some water." When she returned from the kitchen, she sat even closer to me. I wanted to get out of there so badly that sweat started streaming down the sides of my face. She scooted closer. Finally, I spoke. "I have to go. I have a long drive." "You should stay and watch Cops," she insisted. "This is a really good episode." "No, I really should be going. I have a long drive." I stood up and she jumped in front of me, all tall and cockeyed. I tried to walk around her, but she interposed herself between me and the door and puckered up her lips. I pulled back, but she only grew more aggressive. I needed to get out of there. A cockeyed Gina Davis was attacking me. I was going to kill my friend. I ran to my truck and peeled off, forgetting to even say goodbye or, "I had fun, thanks." A minute later, my cell phone rang. It was her. This was turning into a horror movie. "Why'd you leave?" she asked. "Well, you can spend the night if you want. I will do anything you want. Anything." "No, I really can't." "I will be your slave," she said. "I will do you oh so right." "I'm sorry, maybe some other time." "What's the matter?" "Well, you know, you're, cockeyed." That was pretty much the extent of my blind dating experience. I met a cockeyed Gina Davis, then I met a cockeyed Meg Ryan. But I slept with a cockeyed Meg Ryan. Tommy had married Pamela Anderson, so he was feeling pretty high and mighty. "Dude, you gotta stop going out with those regular girls," he told me. "You have to go out with somebody who understands you, who's busy like you are, who goes through the kind of shit you do. You need someone famous. Look through a magazine, find someone interesting." I went to the newsstand and grabbed Details and Premiere. Drew Barrymore seemed kind of fun. Cindy Crawford was good arm candy, and Jenny McCarthy looked like a wild girl who could make me laugh in bed. I drew up a form letter and had Kovac fax a copy to each of their managers, oblivious to the fact that Jenny McCarthy was actually dating her manager. Not only did I not get a single response, but those letters would come back to haunt me. While we were finishing the album in the studio, I saw a copy of Playboy sitting around with a photo of some Baywatch blonde in the back. I noticed that she was a pretty girl, but I didn't think anything else about it. The next day, Tommy said, "Pam wants to introduce you to somebody." "Oh no, who? Some cockeyed David Hasselhoff?" "No, a girl she works with on Baywatch, and she's hot, dude." I didn't really want to go out with some narcissistic actress bimbo, so I tried to back out of it. Besides, Pamela never really liked me anyway, and when I tried to get her to make friends with Brandy, it was like mixing oil and water. However, Scott Humphrey intervened as usual and said that if I didn't want to go on the date, he'd go. So I pulled seniority. Cursing myself for giving in to another stupid blind date, I drove to the Baywatch set. I was standing in the background watching them film a scene around the lifeguard tower when a woman walked on set with beautiful blonde hair and a flowered sarong. It was the woman I had seen in Playboy. "That's her, dude," Tommy nudged me. "No way. That girl would never go out with me." I pictured her being bored as I waffled through dinner about the work we were doing on Generation Swine. I was sure I'd get shot down, and I contemplated sneaking away to save myself the embarrassment. She was too wholesome and all-American for a dirty fucker like me. After the shoot, I walked down the long dirt road to the beach and met her halfway, where Pam introduced us. Her name was Donna, and she couldn't have been any less excited to meet me. She didn't even look at me. She just nodded and walked to her trailer. I guess the last thing she wanted to do was get involved with a tattooed, heroin-shooting womanizer with three kids who was clearly still on the rebound from a messy marriage. I went back to Pam's trailer and waited, wondering if it wasn't too late to make my escape. Donna was clearly thinking the same thing because she walked inside and said, "You know what? I can't go. I don't have anything to wear." All Donna had was a long, loose-fitting pajama top that she had worn to work. "Just wear that," I said. "That's fine." She gave me a dirty look, left the trailer, and came back 10 minutes later in the pajamas. "Fine," she said. "Fuck it. Let's go." The blind date was already a disaster. Tommy and Pam led the way to the Dragonfly in their Suburban. I followed in my Suburban, and Donna brought up the rear in her Pathfinder. It was a stereotypical L.A. date, conducted by motorcade. I kept making sudden turns and racing through yellow lights, hoping she'd get lost. By the time we reached the Dragonfly, I couldn't see her in the rearview mirror anymore. I was safe. But a minute after I got out of my car, she pulled up behind me. I was stuck. We hung out on the patio and started talking. Afterward, we went to a club where everyone was fucked up and dancing. But we stayed sober and talked in a corner about music and about our kids. I was actually enjoying myself. Around midnight, I drove her to her car. I was running out of things to say, so I told her about my house and the swimming pool I was building. "Oh, really? A pool?" she yawned, feigning interest. "Yeah, and it's going to be shaped like a pussy. I've always wanted a pussy-shaped swimming pool so I can just..." "Oh, never mind." She rolled her eyes, and I saw any chance that I might ever have with her fly out the window. I dropped her off at her car and was so embarrassed I didn't even try to kiss her. Back at my big, isolated house, however, I felt so lonely and empty that I called her. I wanted to spend some more time with her and see if she was really as cool as I thought. We made a date to go to a restaurant in Malibu called Bamboo the next night. That morning, I took my kids to the Malibu Fair where I ran into Tommy and Pamela. Pamela was carrying their son, Brandon, and her face was red with anger. Tommy was drunk off his ass trailing behind her, and she was clearly pissed. I told her I was going to see Donna again, and she gave me a patronizing pat on the head. I dropped the kids off at Brandy's, changed into my only set of presentable clothes, and picked Donna up. Over a messy noodle dinner at Bamboo, I started having these feelings that were either genuine love or just rebound obsession. I wasn't sure, especially after I had fallen for Brandy so quickly and so wrongly. I was too scared to look at Donna because it made me nervous just seeing how beautiful she was. When she went to the bathroom, guys came up to the table to congratulate me for being with someone so hot. 12 years ago, I wouldn't have thought anything of it, but marriage had drained away all my self-esteem. Unlike my cockeyed dates with Donna, I wanted to take her out to the beach and talk to her all night. We had so much in common. We were both from small towns, we both loved children, and she was regarded by the world as this Baywatch sex symbol, while I guess I was seen as the same in rock and roll. But in our hearts, we both knew that we were just nerds, Total fucking high school losers who had put on a good act and gotten lucky. Finally, I said to Donna, "Listen, I live just around the corner. Do you want to go to my house? I have some wine, we can kick back, and I can show you some lovely etchings of the pussy-shaped pool I'm building." "Okay, if it's close," she said. "Sure, it'll just take a minute." It was 25 miles away, and I knew it. She followed me in her Pathfinder up the Pacific Coast Highway to Canaan Doom. As we wound our way into the hills, she signaled for me to pull over. "How far are we going?" she asked, exasperated. "We're almost there." I led her all the way through Westlake Village and North Ranch, hoping she wouldn't get fed up and just turn around. Finally, we pulled into my driveway. "What the fuck is this?" she asked when she saw my Richie Rich mansion. She came in, sat on the $10,000 couch Brandy made me buy, and started drinking wine. I was too speechless to drink. I couldn't believe this beautiful girl was sitting on my couch in this house that I only associated with marriage, children, and the worst studio experience of my life. It seemed so wrong, yet I was enjoying it so much. I wanted to kiss her, but I didn't even know where or how to begin because I hadn't done it in so long. I was such a loser, a Frank Farana Jr. Finally, like a true nerd, I asked, "Can I hug you?" She said I could, so I melted into her for 5 minutes. I buried my head in her blonde hair and just lost myself like some kind of old, lecherous, sentimental fool inhaling the aroma of an 18-year-old for the first time in half a century. She had polished off most of the wine, so I suggested that she stay the night. Too nervous that she'd think I had the wrong intention, I quickly said I'd sleep in my bedroom and she could have the guest room. I walked her to the spare room, and before I could leave, she pulled me down onto the bed. Sober, I was able to enjoy every second and every caress. As we rolled around together, I was going out of my mind with lust. I probably had all the subtlety of a dog humping a doorknob. It had been such a long time since I was last pressed against a beautiful woman I actually liked and respected. I wanted to fuck her so badly, but I was so turned on I knew it would only last a second. Then she'd hate me because I'd be the lamest fuck of her life. "I have to go to my room," I told her.
"No," she whispered. "Stay."
I was exhausted because I wasn't used to staying up so late, but I was so excited to be lying next to this panty-clad bombshell that it took me hours to fall asleep. When I awoke, the sun was rising, and she was gone. I rolled out of bed, put on my robe, and found her smoking a cigarette on a veranda overlooking the future site of my giant pussy pool. Her back was to me, and she was gazing out at the multi-million-dollar mansions of my neighbors. "What are you doing?" I asked, as I stepped through the veranda door. She turned around startled and saw this ugly rock star in a robe coming out of a giant white marble-filled house lit up by the rising sun. It looked like a scene from Scarface. "This is way too much for me to handle," she said. "I'm out of here." "You can't leave. You can't leave," I begged. She grabbed the rest of her clothes and ran out to her car with me in my robe, offering her anything if she'd just stay. She peeled out of the driveway and I stood there alone, knowing exactly how the cockeyed Gina Davis must have felt when I left. I was a monster who wine had somehow made attractive to this girl for about 2 hours. I sat down on the bed and started writing. "She's so afraid of love, is so afraid of hate. What's she running from now?" The song was called Afraid, and it was about both of us. In less than 48 hours, I had gone from being repulsed by this girl to falling in love with her, to having my heart broken, to being repulsed with myself. I fell into a fitful sleep for a few hours, then left her a message. Breaking every rule of making a woman want you by not seeming too eager, I told her that I hadn't felt so alive in a long time and I begged her to call me. She did, and apologized for running off scared. She had been so drunk, she said, that she couldn't even remember whether we had fucked. I told her that we had fucked all night and that afterward she had said I was the best lay she'd ever had. After a few more dates, just when everything was starting to work out, Donna screeched into my driveway and came charging at me waving a fax I had written. Evidently, Jenny McCarthy's manager and boyfriend worked with Donna's manager. And when he heard about the new man in Donna's life, he produced the form letter that I had written to Jenny McCarthy asking for a date. All of a sudden, I went in Donna's estimation from being a lonely, lovable rock star to a misogynist star fucker. To make matters worse, that afternoon we were playing with my son Gunner when Brandy burst into the house saying that it was her week to have him. Gunner was having a good time and didn't want to leave, but Brandy insisted. Though Gunner began to scream and cry, she didn't seem to care at all. In front of Donna and Gunner, she started to yell and humiliate me. I stormed out of the room, loaded the 9mm gun in my room, and swore that this time I'd do it. I was going to shoot that cold-hearted bitch in the head. I could hear Gunner's screams reverberating through the house. All my logic circuitry shut down, and my mind went black with anger. I came tearing into the hallway, but Donna caught me. "Take it easy, Scarface," she said. After a few minutes of arguing, I handed her the gun and barreled past her into my son's room. But Brandy and Gunner were nowhere to be found. She had already left with him. I collapsed onto Gunner's bed and burst into tears. I was a total fuck-up. I had probably scared Donna away forever. A funny thing about girls, though, is that the more you do wrong, the more they like you. Between those stupid faxes and my uncontrollable temper tantrum, she could see that I was a lost little boy who was badly in need of help. So she began helping me. The next day, she came over to my house with a gift-wrapped present, a 15-disc CD-ROM called Family Tree Maker. I typed in my name, then my father's name. The CD drive word and my parents' names appeared on the screen. Below them was my birth name and that of my brother, Randy Farana. Wait, my brother Randy? I didn't have any brothers.
Chapter 5 Tommy. In which the reader learns the fate of Tommy Lee's strongbox and the video cassette contained therein. Nobody thought it would work, but it did, for a while. Pamela and I were so fucking happy. Everything in our personality seemed to mesh. She wanted a child more than anything in the world, which was exactly what I'd been wanting since my marriage to Heather. And Pamela was a lot more easygoing and fun to be with. Together, we came up with all kinds of ideas, from furniture companies we wanted to start, to clothing lines, to screenplays. Instead of holding back our ambitions, our marriage only kicked them into high gear. Her mother and brother eventually apologized and gave the marriage their support, and it was all good. Except for the photographers, who followed us fucking everywhere. I didn't really understand the paparazzi because I'd never experienced anything this crazy with Heather. Back then, the shit was more organized. With Pamela, it was a whole other level of stalking. Photographers would pop out of bushes when we left the house and start high-speed chases with us down the freeway. I couldn't understand why people wanted so many pictures of her. Maybe if we were naked on the beach, I'd understand, but what was so exciting about us walking down the street or getting out of our cars? Everywhere we went, someone would yell, "Pamela!" or "Tommy!" And if we turned, a million flashbulbs went off. If we didn't turn, they'd start booing and cussing us out. It became a sick game trying to invent elaborate schemes to avoid them, sending her assistant out of the house in a decoy blonde wig or switching cars to throw them off our trail. After a few weeks of being treated like dog shit by the paparazzi, we started thinking of them as fucking maggots. I wanted to crush them all. It wasn't so much the invasiveness as it was the lack of respect for us as human beings. When Pamela collapsed and lost our first child due to a miscarriage, a Lee family curse, my mother said, the paparazzi were so intent on getting photos, they kept cutting off the ambulance on the way to the hospital. Fuck, dude. I could deal with them trying to crash our parties, but trying to crash our ambulance was another story. It bummed me out because I'd been wanting kids for so long. I was so jealous of Nicky because he had such beautiful fucking kids. Whenever I was at his place, I'd regress to a 2-year-old and play with them for hours. I liked going back to that time in my life when everything was innocent and meaningless. I was depressed for months after Pamela's miscarriage. To cheer us up and get our minds off it,
Pamela threw a fucking $300,000 surprise party when I turned 33. I came home that night and she said, I want you to dress like a king. She grabbed a big-ass purple robe and a crazy crown she had bought. Then a makeup artist covered me with white face powder so that I looked like the Crow or something. Pamela dressed up as a ringleader in a big old top hat, grabbed me by the hand, and led me to our driveway, where a tour bus covered with birthday banners had pulled up. Inside, there were 9 midgets singing Happy Birthday. Champagne was flowing, and a dozen of my friends were dressed in drag. We rode for 10 minutes to a nearby place called the Semler Ranch, and I stepped off the bus into my own personal Fellini movie. 2 rows of flame stretched out for hundreds of feet in front of me. Midgets were everywhere, saying in their helium voices,
Welcome to Tommyland! Welcome to Tommyland! Hee-hee-hee!
As they unrolled a red carpet between the lines of fire. In the meantime, all kinds of clowns and acrobats materialized, filling the air with confetti. I wasn't even on drugs yet, but I felt like I was. Pamela, the ringleader, led me and my friends in a parade down the carpet. Ahead of us, a giant on stilts dressed as the devil walked through the tangle of midgets, parting them like a sea. Past him, there was a big sign that said Tommyland, with a crazy-looking clown on it. As I approached the sign, I realized that Pamela had basically set up an entire amusement park for me. There were fucking Ferris wheels, roller coasters, contortionists in boxes, caged lions, and bubble machines. Underneath an immense tent, a professional concert stage had been loaded up with drums and all kinds of gear for a jam. Also on the stage was my baby grand piano, which Pamela had tricked out with gold leaf paintings of koi fish and customized wrought iron legs. Fucking Slash and the Guns N' Roses dudes were there, as was our friend Bobby Avorgi and his band at the time, the Electric Love Hogs. She brought in dudes from the Cirque du Soleil, which we loved, and cranked our favorite band, Radiohead, on the sound system. There were all kinds of gourmet food dishes, designer drugs, Tahitian dancers, Balinese percussionists, and moving lights, plus a crew with 35mm film and a sound truck to document it all. At 3 a.m., she brought me a cake with fucking Mighty Mouse on it, because he always gets the girl, dude. And then we all played midget football on our knees. It was an amazing fucking party from hell. But at the end of the night, when I was all shitty with drugs and alcohol, a dozen ambulances came screaming into the ranch. What the fuck's going on? I panicked, grabbing Pamela.
Don't worry, she said. I hired ambulances to take everyone home because I knew they'd all get too fucked up to drive.
At 7 a.m., I was brought into my bedroom on a big-ass stretcher. I always told her that one day, when I wasn't in a rock band anymore and she was through with acting, we would start a party planning company. She scored such amazing satisfaction from pulling off crazy, elaborate parties that ran without a hitch. 10 days after my birthday, Pamela told me that she was 4 weeks pregnant. I couldn't have been any happier, dude. We wanted to have a completely natural, drug-free home birth. We didn't want any fucking ugly hospital lights and none of that butt-slapping, stainless steel scale-weighing, needle-poking attitude you get in a maternity ward. With soft music, candlelight, and a midwife on either side of her, Pamela gave birth to Brandon Thomas Lee at 3:02 a.m. on May 6, 1996, after 17 hours of labor for her and 400 cigarettes for me. The tears came flooding out when I saw this fucking person come out of my wife right in the fucking master bedroom where we conceived him. I even got to help pull him out, dude. That was hands down the most golden day of my life. And half an hour later, I sat down at the piano and the song Brandon just came out of me. I didn't realize it at the time because I was so overjoyed, but there was a downside to all this. Pamela and I got busy having kids so quickly that we never gave ourselves a chance to build a solid relationship. When you combine the time that it takes to be a parent with the time we both devote to our careers, there's hardly a minute left. I asked her much later, why didn't we work on our relationship more?
We couldn't, she replied. I was pregnant the whole time.
When you're in love with someone, there's nothing you want to do more than create a baby that's equal parts you and her. But once you do, you are consigning your love to the trash bin. Because in having a child, you are creating your greatest rival, the person your wife is going to love more than you. Where a husband and wife relationship is all about conditions, contracts, marriage licenses, blood tests, mother-child relationship is all about unconditional love. In both, getting what we wanted more than anything in the world, a beautiful boy, and soon after, a second son, we doomed ourselves before we even started. Then there were other factors beyond our control. Pamela and I were chowing down on some dinner and flipping through television stations when we heard our names being mentioned on some news show. On the screen, there was a dude at Tower Video stocking the shelves with videotapes. And we knew just what they were. Months earlier, we had taken a 5-day houseboat trip on Lake Mead as a vacation. As usual, I brought along my video camera. We weren't trying to make a porno, just to document our vacation. We watched it once when we returned home, then put it in our safe. The safe was a 500-pound monstrosity hidden underneath a carpet in my studio control room in the garage, where we recorded part of Generation Swine. Pamela and I spent that Christmas in London while some work was being done on the house. Afterward, I finished recording in the basement and then dismantled the studio. When the carpet was torn out, I saw nothing but empty space where the safe had once been. There were no broken locks or windows, so it had to have been an inside job. The only people with the keys were my assistant and the construction crew, which, come to think of it, included an electrician who used to be a porn star and knew that business pretty well. The way I figured it, they must have removed the safe with a crane, taken it back to one of their houses, and had it picked or blown open. They were probably after the guns and jewelry in there, but they also ended up with everything personal that was important to us, from family heirlooms to photographs. I was so freaked out that I fired the assistant and sicked my lawyers on the construction company. The next thing I knew, there was a porn peddler from a company called the Internet Entertainment Group phoning me. He said he had bought the tape and was going to broadcast it on the Internet. We had Pamela's lawyers send them a cease and desist order, but for some reason, it didn't arrive on time. Our lawyers and managers advised us that the best way to minimize the damages was to sign a contract saying that, since the company had us by the balls, we would reluctantly allow a one-time webcast so long as they didn't sell, copy, trade, or rebroadcast it. We thought we had won. Hardly anyone would see the video on the Internet, and we could recover the tape and start over. So, as soon as we saw the shelves being stocked at Tower on the news, we realized the guy had breached his agreement and mass-produced the tape, which, by the way, he never returned to us. I instantly called my lawyer, and we took them to court. All of this was going down at a real hard time for us, and Pamela and I were getting in fights all the time. Trying to have children, continue the careers that consumed us, make a new relationship work, and deal with a non-stop barrage of bullshit in the press was more of a challenge than we ever could have expected. Before Brandon was born, we had a huge blow-up because, with everything unraveling at once, we both became extra sensitive to each other's slightest change in mood. If one person said or did something wrong, the other one bristled with hate and resentment. We had little tiffs over nothing all the time.
"You are a selfish little baby who thinks of nobody but himself," Pamela fumed one night over some little thing we had pumped into a major issue. I can't even remember what it was anymore.
"I do not want to deal with this," I snapped back.
"It doesn't fucking matter. I'm so sick of wasting our time arguing." "You never want to talk about anything," she fumed. "I used to think you were so sweet. You tricked me."
And with that, she stormed out of the house and went to spend the night at her condo. Hours later, the phone rang. I picked it up, expecting to hear Pamela on the other end, but instead, a man started speaking. He identified himself as a doctor and said Pamela had swallowed half a bottle of aspirin at her place and blacked out. She was found unconscious on her bed by a girlfriend who had come over to spend the night and console her. I rushed to the hospital to see her, though the overdose was probably less a suicide attempt than a plea for attention. But it worked, because I had no idea how much our disagreements were affecting her. To throw the news hounds off the scent but give them something real to report, we issued a press statement announcing that Pamela had checked into the hospital
with what she thought were flu symptoms, only to discover that she was pregnant. I tried my best to keep my cool after the drama, but it kept getting harder while the news kept getting worse. First, the internet entertainment group started selling a tape of Pamela having sex with Brett Michaels from Poison. Then, the judge in our video case shut Pamela and me down on every privacy issue and allowed the sale of the tape because he ruled that the content was newsworthy. It pissed me off, because I don't ever want my kids to go to a friend's house and find a video of their parents fucking in the VCR. I finally broke down and watched the thing. I couldn't see the big deal. It's really just our vacation tape. There's only a little bit of fucking on there. That hasn't stopped Ron Jeremy, though, from trying to get me to make a fuck flick for him. I guess if my career as a musician ever fails, I can always be a porn star.
Chapter 6 Nikki. In which, piece by piece, all that our hero knows of his life, his music, his finances, and his attitude toward oral sex comes crashing down. Hi, I'm calling for Randy. I believe that you are my half-brother. If your father is Frank Ferrana, could you please call me? I don't know if he is dead or alive. My mother was Deanna, and my name is Nikki, or Frank. That was the message I left Randy Ferrana. An hour later, his wife called me back and said that she vaguely remembered his father mentioning a half-brother. I talked to Randy later that night. He was 4 years older than me, ran a vacation resort in San Jose, and had grown up on Motley Crue records, though he had no idea he was banging his head to the music of a blood relation. I knew of a lady named Deanna, he said, and I heard she had a son with my dad, but he never mentioned you. My dad, our dad, was a womanizer and a raging alcoholic. He was a wild man, I've been told. But is he alive? I asked. I want to talk to him. He died on Christmas Day in 1987. He had a heart attack in the shower. Randy told me that our father was buried in San Jose. I had really wanted to meet my dad after all these years, to just look at him and find out more about who I was, what I would become, and even what diseases I was genetically prone to. Most of all, I wanted to know why he never wanted to have anything to do with me my whole life. Since he was dead and buried, I figured that was the end of that. I was probably better off not finding him alive, because I only would have been rebuked again and further embittered. I remembered all the optimistic thoughts I entertained when I flew to Seattle to reunite with my mother, only to find a paranoid woman in a mental hospital who would never forgive me and who I could never forgive. Donna encouraged me to follow through with my plan of making peace with my father. His death was not a setback, I finally decided, but an advantage, because that way he couldn't talk back to me. So we flew to San Jose and visited his grave. Donna brought along a video camera and filmed me walking through the cemetery, finding his tombstone and spitting on it. Fuck you, I yelled at him. You fucking walk out on me when I'm 3. Don't even say